And Nicole, as a leader, if you ever want to switch up a hymn on us, feel free. You're the leader. We'll play along with it. Our passage this morning is from Exodus chapter 16, verses 1 through 16. And the author writes, "The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt." Did everyone get that? Did those references give you full clarity on when and where we're talking about right now? Not my first go around either. Verse 2, "In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, 'If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you have brought us into the desert to starve the entire assembly to death.' Then the Lord said to Moses, 'I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way, I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. On the sixth day, they're to prepare what they bring in, and that is to be twice as much as they gathered on the other days.' So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, 'In the evening, you will know that it is the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, and in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we that you should grumble against us?' Moses also said, 'You will know that it was the Lord when he gives you the meat to eat, and in the evening when all the bread you want in the morning, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we? You are not grumbling against us, but against the Lord.' Then Moses told Aaron, 'Say to the entire Israelite community, come before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling.' While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked towards the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. The Lord said to Moses, 'I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight, you will eat meat. In the morning, you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God.' That evening, quail came and covered the camp. And in the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, 'What is it?' For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, 'It is the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Everyone is to gather as much as they need.'" Friends, this is the word of the Lord, and together we say, thanks be to God. It's interesting that ancient interpreters and commentators of the Old Testament point out that the manna or bread that God provided for his people is talked about in different ways in different parts of the Old Testament. For example, in the book of Numbers, when it's talking about manna, it says, "And when the dew came down upon the camp at night, the manna came down upon it." It seems to suggest that the manna fell down within the camp of the Israelites. But in our passage today, it says, "I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for the day." This seems to suggest that the manna fell just outside of the camp. They had to go get it. They didn't have to go very far, but they had to go get it. Later in Exodus, it says that they went out and looked for manna in the wilderness. It seems to suggest that manna was outside of the camp. This time, you actually had to walk a decent amount of distance to go find it. So the ancient commentators, the ancient interpreters of these passages, they asked a good question. How is it that manna falls inside the camp, just outside the camp, and far enough to where people have to go search for it? These ancient Old Testament commentators and interpreters, they concluded that these passages are all accurate. Manna absolutely fell within the camp. It absolutely fell just outside the camp, and it absolutely fell far enough that they had to go walk a decent amount to get there. And this is how they made sense of it. This is how they explained and answered their own question. They said, where you received the manna depended on how or what type of person you are, how righteous or how wicked you are. For example, they concluded, for the righteous people, manna came down within their camp right by their tent. Very little effort to collect it. For the average person, the person who wasn't completely righteous and the person who wasn't completely wicked, it didn't fall down right in the camp. They had to go get their manna just outside the camp. So they had to go get it, but they didn't have to walk very far. But for the wicked person, they had to actually go walk a distance, maybe even go search for the manna. Are you with me so far? Do you understand what they're saying here? So if you're good, God rewards you by putting your manna just outside your tent flap when you're camping. And not only that, these same ancient Old Testament commentators, interpreters, they concluded that the degree to which a person is righteous or wicked not only dictates how you receive or where you receive your manna, it also dictates how you receive the manna from God as well. They point out that there are actually three different words used in the original language, which is the language that these ancient interpreters used, to describe manna. There's a word to describe manna that's the word for bread, like bread that was already ready to eat. All you had to do was break it and eat. There's a word that's used to describe manna that refers to kind of baked goods, like dough. It's all prepared, but you have to go through the step of cooking it. And then there's a word to describe manna that basically refers to just kind of the raw ingredients. You had to start kind of at square one with the ingredients that God provided. So for the righteous, you were rewarded. You were given bread as you want bread, ready to eat, and it was delivered right to your tent, which is kind of like Grubhub. You know, it's kind of like room service. This is wonderful. If you were somewhere in the middle, it was okay. The manna was received, it was prepared, but you still had to cook it, and you had to go a little bit of a ways to find it. If you were wicked, it was a lot of work. They had to start at square one. They had to go find the raw ingredients of this manna, and they needed to gather it and thresh it and winnow it, whatever that means, and ground it in a mill and all that kind of stuff. Do you understand what these ancient interpreters are saying? These ancient interpreters and commentators, their explanation of where you received manna from God, how you received manna from God, was dependent on how righteous or how wicked you are. There's this idea in their interpretation, there's this idea in their commentary that if you behave well, if you are righteous, then you are going to impress God in some way, and then he's going to bless you more so than people who are not righteous. But if you're wicked, then you don't receive God's favor as much. He's still giving you manna, but he's making you work for it. If the conclusions of these ancient interpreters and commentators is true, and I mean if because I don't know if it is, but if it was true, can you imagine the divisions that would have existed between people based on how and where they received the manna from God? Can you imagine that? Can you imagine a situation where the religious and the spiritual create some sort of a hierarchy that would be created among God's people based on where they received their manna and to what degree it was ready to eat? Can you imagine a situation where the righteous people felt like they were prioritized above everyone else? Can you imagine a situation where the righteous figured it was their place to tell everybody else how to live and point out how they sin differently than they do? Can you imagine any of this happening based on how and where you receive manna? And can you imagine a situation where those who actually had to go out and gather their manna and put in some effort to create bread, can you imagine that they ever felt inferior to other people? Can you imagine a situation where those who were seen as wicked felt that God, ultimate reality, the creator, redeemer, sustainer of all things in heaven and on earth, saw them as less valuable than other people? Can you imagine a situation based on how people received manna and where they got it, where the people who were seen as wicked figured it was their place just to listen to other people and the instructions they give them? And can you imagine how crushing it would be to think that God, ultimate reality, the giver and protector of life, when he sees you, his conclusion is, based on how you got your manna and where you got your manna, that you are wicked at your core. I can't imagine how crushing that would be. The creator, redeemer, sustainer of all things in heaven on earth, announcing day after day, year after year, that he's displeased with who you are. Friends, that's not good news. And this morning I have good news, because the birth, life, teaching, ministry, miracles, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, we never, never have to pretend that our behavior has anything to do with the way God blesses us. Because of the life and death and ministry of Jesus, we never, never have to be crushed by the thought that when God sees us, he doesn't see us as valuable as somebody else. That way of thinking about God, the way of thinking about God that we see kind of in these ancient commentators and interpreters, it's not good news. There's no grace there. Jesus seemed very, very intentional and interested in tearing down the idea that human behavior results in any way in God's blessing towards them. Jesus seemed very intentional and interested in tearing down the idea that anybody, when God sees them at the core, God sees someone who's unworthy and wicked. Jesus didn't play in those categories at all. Ancient Old Testament commentators and interpreters, they might have understood the world in those categories, but not Jesus. The idea was that the good news was rewarded to those people in Israel who acted in a righteous way. But Jesus introduced a whole nother option. It's the way of not earning things, it's the way of grace. Grace means that there is bread, there is manna available for everyone. And that is really good news. If the bread you get, there's bread available for everyone, but if the bread you get is delivered to you in a way that's a little bit more convenient than somebody else, it's not because of your righteousness, but it absolutely means that there's more expected from you. There's a story in John chapter 7 that illustrates this idea of grace that you're probably familiar with. It says, "But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and they sat down as he taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees, these are the righteous people, those who would have thought that God was going to deliver them the bread and fully baked right by their tent. That's these people, the Pharisees. They brought a woman who had been caught in adultery and placed her in the midst of Jesus." Okay, so this is someone they saw as wicked, someone who is different than them, someone who would have to go find manna and put in a lot of work. "They," the righteous people, "said to Jesus, 'Teacher, this woman, the wicked woman, has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law," it talks about being good and bad, "Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. So what do you say?" "This," they, the righteous people, "said to him to test Jesus so they might bring a charge against him. Jesus bent down and he began to write with his finger in the ground. As they continued to ask him, Jesus stood up and he said to them, let the righteous person among you, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. And once more he bent down and he began to write on the ground. But when they," the righteous people, who saw this difference between the righteous and the wicked, "when the righteous people heard this, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. And Jesus was left alone with this woman," this wicked woman, "standing before him. And Jesus stood up and said to her, 'Woman, where are they? Where are the righteous people? Has no one condemned you?' She said, 'No one, Lord.' And Jesus said, 'Neither do I condemn you. And now go from here and sin no more.'" Friends, that is an example. That is a story of what Chuck Swindoll calls scandalous grace. There's grace in the way that Jesus de-escalates this tense, conflicted situation by simply writing on the ground something mysterious we don't know. How many of you have ever wondered what Jesus was writing in the sand that day? I know a lot of you have. There's grace in the way that Jesus caused the righteous people to actually engage in some sort of self-evaluation. There's grace in the beauty of restoring life and dignity and honor to this woman. There's grace in the way that Jesus sees more to this woman than simply the sin she was engaging in. There's grace in the way that Jesus saves the religious people from the idea that there's something better about them than the woman who was caught in adultery. There's grace in the way that Jesus helps the religious people to finally recognize that there's only one person in the story who has the ability to judge anybody else and is qualified for that, and it's not them. And finally, there's grace in Jesus' order of operation here. Notice, the first thing that he does is he offers her love and forgiveness and grace and acceptance. And then, only because he's Jesus, the religious people, the righteous people couldn't do this, then he instructs her to go and sin no more. He doesn't say, go and sin no more, and then when you figured it out, come back to me and I'll offer you some love and forgiveness at that point. 25 years ago, Philip Yancey, he wrote a book that was titled, What's So Amazing About Grace? The book is about how grace, the book is about how the way of Jesus plays out in people who follow the way of Jesus that he's seen over his lifetime. A couple of months ago, Christianity Today did an interview with him, kind of celebrating and honoring the fact that that book's been in print for 25 years. And Yancey said that 25 years after writing his book, he says, we are still in need of grace. We're still living in fear. He says Jesus talked about grace all the time. In his book, he describes a world where Jesus sees a world filled with God's grace all around him, where the sun shines on the good and the bad, the righteous and the wicked, where the birds gathered seeds that God gave them. They didn't have to plow for them. They didn't have to harvest them. He talks about wildflowers blooming on rocky hillsides. He says Jesus saw and talked about grace everywhere. He was always talking about it. Yancey goes on to say, if there was ever a time for a message on grace, it wasn't 25 years ago. The time is now. He says, I coined the word ungrace in his book. And he says, it seems to me that ungrace is always present, especially now. It seems to take different forms. He says in the world, the evangelical world that he grew up in, he says ungrace kind of produced a lot of fear. Fear of hell, fear of the world, fear of culture, fear of a Catholic president, fear of a Left Behind book series, fear of people who are different than them, fear of communism. He says that fear is ungrace. And he says we need grace, which is opposed to fear. He said grace is going to happen when we finally remember why we're here. And he talks about Jesus' last meeting with his disciples. And what does he do? He washes their feet. Jesus said to his disciples, he says, this is a symbol of our stance in the world. This is why we're here. We're here to be servants, not leaders. Then he said, we should be known by our love, not by what we fear. We should be known by our unity, not by how we divide. Those three things, being servant, being about love, being unity together, that's who you are. That shows what grace is. He says to be about grace, we have to remember why we're here. We're here not to create fear and division. We're here to form the type of community that makes people on the outside go, oh, so that's what God had in mind. And they're compelled by it. We love people. We serve people. And together, we show the world what God is like. In another example from a book, in the book Explaining Grace, Robert Farrar, his book Kingdom, Grace, and Judgment. He explains grace in this way and God's grace to us. He says, suppose I were to tell you that I had already buried on your property, I know that's weird, someone on your property, it's just an example, but imagine that I buried on your property under a flat rock $1 million in cash, in $1,000 bills. And suppose I were also to tell you that I have no intention of ever taking that $1 million back. It's there, it's yours, that's it. On one level, I've given you really, really good news. You now have $1 million, no conditions attached. It is all yours. Friends, that's grace. How many would agree? We would be okay with that kind of grace. And if you believe me, not me, but the author, and if you trusted me, and you go to your property and you start flipping over flat rocks, sooner or later, you're going to be able to find that, and you're going to hold, and you're going to experience, and you're going to possess the $1 million that I told you I gave to you, and I did. But he says this, note something really important. Your faith, your trust, your turning over rocks does not earn you that money. That money is grace. It was already yours. It's unmerited. Nor does your trust or your turning over rocks mandate that I gave you the money. It's already yours. I already buried it. The money was yours all along. Just because I was crazy enough about you in order to give you $1 million. Your faith, your digging, what you do, your righteousness is not the cause of the gift. The cause of the gift is love and grace. The Old Testament interpreters, the Old Testament commentators, they suggest that what you do, your faith, your righteousness, your so-and-so, your obedience to the law, that earns you, that makes you merit something. Jesus is talking about something completely different. The ancient Old Testament commentators, they suggest that good behavior earns special blessing from God. The where and how you receive manna. But you got to remember, manna is all grace. Earning manna is not good news. All that does is it causes division. All that does is causes fear. But Jesus gave the woman love and grace and a place to belong. It was all hers to begin with. Not because she was righteous. She was the opposite of righteous at the time. But because of her faith, her trust in Jesus allowed her to grab on and to hold the grace that he was trying to offer her. Do you see the difference? It's religion of earning versus the grace of belonging. Later in his book, Robert Farrar, he continues, he says, for Christians, for followers of Jesus, for us, he says, the entire religion shop has been closed, boarded up, and forgotten. The church is not about the religion, fear, ungrace business. I actually added the fear and ungrace to tie it back to Yancey, but you get the idea. The church is not about the religious business. It never has been and it never will be. In fact, of the few people through 2,000 years who keep trying to bring it back to that. He says, instead, the church, we the people of God, we're not in the religious business. We are about the gospel proclaiming business. We're not here to bring the world bad news, that God will finally think kindly about you only after you've gone through the certain creeds, liturgy, and ethical wickets. That's not good news. The church is here to bring the good news of Jesus, that while you were still sinners, that's when Christ died for us. We are here to serve. We are here to love. We are here to bring together, not for any religious purposes at all, but to announce the gospel of grace that Jesus showed us. Friends, that is good news. May that be what we are about. Will you join me in prayer? Heavenly Father, we thank you for the life of Jesus, which completely continues to surprise us. God, so often we fall into this rhythm of give and take. If we give something, then we get something in return. But that's not the way that you think about this. God, may we be people who do not deliver bad news. May we not be people who deliver fear and ungrace and religion. But may we, like Jesus, look for and announce amazing grace wherever and whenever we see it. May that be what we're about. We thank you for the grace that you give to us. May we be thankful and show gratitude for that. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.